the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. This is another talk in a series on the master-disciple relationship. I'm going to try to describe something this morning that's absolutely essential to understanding, undertaking the master-disciple relationship and successfully doing it. And the difficult thing about it is that because our head is so often out of harmony with our Buddha nature, this is something that we are so easily deceived about, that it's easier to talk about what to do and not to do in practice than to explain the reason why. Because the brain can immediately come up with the counter arguments, and does. And if one goes with those counter arguments, one simply is going to get nowhere with regard to the deeper aspects of training. The basic delusion that provides the slick answers is the love and light delusion. River Master called this the lie that sounds most like truth, and therefore the most dangerous of all delusions. The love and light delusion is basically a deluded understanding of what is called the all is one. And it sweeps away so much that is essential in religion that you're left with just an empty shell, really. I don't really think of this shell. When I think of love and light delusion, I think of a kind of a mist. You're left with a miasma, a fog, an illusion that gives a kind of illusory comfort, but within which there's no real refuge. And it just is a really good mask for a lot of selfishness and irresponsibility. The lie that sounds most like truth. Basically, this is a talk about commitment. And the absolutely essential, the commitment is absolutely essential to undertaking deep spiritual training, and that the very essence of what we mean by commitment is encapsulated in the master-disciple relationship. And that to undertake training in the master-disciple relationship, there has to be the deepest possible human commitment to following another person and following their teaching. So let's see, just take a quick look, an initial quick look at how the love and light delusion undermines that. And it's perfect logic. Everyone has the Buddha nature. Everyone has a Buddha nature. All is one. Everything is part of the eternal. Okay? That's the starting point. That's a premise that's completely true. Everyone has a Buddha nature. Therefore, it's the therefore where you get in trouble. Therefore, how can you possibly just pick one person to be your teacher and follow that person? Everyone has a Buddha nature. Everyone offers another aspect of the one truth. So you can learn from everyone and everything. Also true, you can learn from everyone and everything. Therefore, just take everything as your teacher. And you don't need to actually commit to a particular teacher and following the path that teacher is walking. And you do take a teacher and the teacher's opinions differ from yours, well, go find someone else with a Buddha nature to follow, because, you know, there's an infinite number of Buddha natures out there to follow. And there you go. You've lost it completely there, the point of religion. And this is not a true understanding of oneness. This is a delusion of oneness, an ideology of oneness. And it does not effect a conversion. It's much more dangerous when a partial conversion has taken place and someone has had a genuine experience of the oneness, hasn't just heard about it or had a little occasional flash or taken some drug and gotten a little flash of something beyond their normal experience. But someone's had an actual Kensho experience. Now they really know all is one. And then, you know, this is why they watch people like a hawk after a really big Kensho, especially in the early years of training. Because sure enough, at some point, you know, you'll start, everyone to some extent or other will go down that road of becoming God in their own head and deciding that they know as much as the teacher. For almost everyone. And whether they do or not, it doesn't matter. If the grass starts to be greener on the other side of the fence, then one's going to end up departing from the path that one started in. If you don't stick on your path, you don't go where the path leads you. And if you start on another after having gone a seriously important stretch on one path, then what's to stop you when you get a certain distance on that path simply abandoning that one and going for another? And that's what happens. Once someone starts to do a runner like that, they'll keep doing it. That's my actual experience. Seen it over and over and over again. Your one experience of the truth does not convert a whole of karma. Not by a long shot. In fact, it usually the one really starts to go through it after a first Kensho. And really, because the karma then sees, well, now there's the opportunity to get the need within one. Senses, this is the time I can really start to get some serious help, because here's someone who really has found the eternal. Then you have to stick with the training. You have to cook this stuff that's boiling up in you. Not just let it run you around. In the relationship with the master, if you are true and faithful to that relationship, that'll keep your nose to the grindstone. So you don't just wander off into cloud cuckoo land without even noticing that you're doing it. There's a story that Rim Master used to tell about, I think it was actually a story, a yogic story from India originally, I think, of a disciple who climbed up one of these ropes that goes up into heaven, you know, kind of a mythological rope into heaven. And he got up into heaven and he wouldn't come down, so the master climbed up the rope and chopped him into pieces and threw him down. And of course, that's a metaphor for what the master so often has to do with the disciple. Give them the grim truth, whether they like it or not. When they're starting to get swollen headed and clinging to a particular experience of oneness, a particular ideal of oneness, all all is one and all is different. We can't get stuck. We have to keep going. And it's a hard slog, long beyond the first Kensho. So it should be clear from this that without a profound commitment to training with one's teacher, training under the guidance of one's teacher, following one's teacher, was not going to go down this road. Because it's actually just too, the cost is too great without that commitment. It, you know, the thing about the love and light delusion is that it basically tells you can have it all without paying the price. You don't have to give something up. If all is one, what is there to give up? If everyone has a piece of the truth, if you don't like what the teacher teaches you, go to someone else and get their advice until you find someone you agree with, who agrees with you. If all is one, then there's Buddha everywhere. How can you give up Buddha? So you don't have to give anything up. You don't have to cut loose from everything. Anything. You don't have to pay any price. And so one stays always at the starting gate and never goes down the track with that approach. It's the lie that sounds like truth. And it when you're in the midst of it, it is the most bewildering thing. Because if you really have found your spiritual center, it feels like when you're in the midst of it with other people who are in this delusion, it feels like your head's being pulled away from your body, basically. Because it's so much in the head. Needless to say, I mean, this is all over the place in the modern world. But the modern world did not create this delusion. It goes all the way back, and it's just a good old essential delusion, religious delusion. And religious delusion is more dangerous to religious people than worldly delusion. Because after all, you more easily recognize some rampant breakage of the precepts as being some, ooh, I don't want to do that. You know, that's not a path of faith and of the precepts. It's much harder to recognize it when it comes disguised as the truth. It's much harder to recognize when it comes disguised as the truth. Well, you've got to listen to your guts. It doesn't matter what people say. It doesn't matter how their external actions, of how they appear to you. What matters is what your heart says about it. Whether this is good to join in with or not. Whether this is good to avoid or not. True masters do not appear holy and calm necessarily. True masters can seem to be not very peaceful some of the time, and can be very disruptive personalities. Following the eternal doesn't require you to know anything in particular either. Not even that you're following the eternal. One Zen master explained it as reaching for your pillow in the night in your sleep. So when conversion has gone sufficiently far in someone, they do the following without following, as it were, just as they do the meditating without meditation. The following is happening through their very being. The meditation is happening through their very being. Because there's no longer a block between them and the eternal. Reverend Master Jiu was an incredible example of this. You could be sitting around with her and someone would do something. Sometimes if it was you, you know, you'd be, you know, rubbing your head for the next day or so, and she'd give you a hard verbal clobber, or give someone a verbal clobber, And in the next instant, it was dropped and she was moved on to something else entirely. And you felt quite a fool when you realized if you held on to it and you're going around thinking, you know, Rim Master, you know, just it proves it. That just proves everything I've been thinking, you know. Everything. And then next time you see her, she's all sunny and warm and, oh, it's like you're your long lost best friend. She let it go. She let it go. Just instinctive reaction and then letting it go. But not animal instinct, spiritual instinct. The implications for this, if you explore the implications a bit of what I'm saying, they run very deep and they run into every aspect of one's life and one's training. I have sometimes cautioned people that if they come to me for advice and they don't hear something that they readily understand or that they like, to don't go running to someone else to get another opinion on it, a second opinion. I've had people who do this and have told me they do it. And I've seen people be harmed by it. What is the attitude with which one takes in teaching from a teacher? I presume if people ask me for sanzen, if they ask me for my spiritual advice, that they're going to take it seriously. As I took it seriously when I asked for Master Jiu. It's not just a chat with a friend. If you want to chat with a friend, go chat with a friend. But if you ask for sanzen, listen with your whole being and go away and meditate with it. If you don't like it, often that's a sign that something's actually got in or trying to get in, something's trying to get through. Sit with it. You don't have to immediately think, oh yes, that's wonderful, I believe it. You know, don't violate something in yourself before, you know, don't violate something in yourself in order to think of yourself as someone full of faith. That's not the point. If the teaching gives rise to doubts, then meditate with the doubt. If the teaching gives rise to irritation, meditate with the irritability. If the teaching gives rise to fear, meditate with the fear. Meditate with it. If it's strong, it's a strong reminder, take it to the eternal, ask for help. Sit with it. And cook it. Cook that teaching. If you go running first opportunity to someone else, another monk, a friend, for God's sake, a psychologist, to get another opinion, you'll hurt yourself. Not because the teacher's right, and you didn't do the right thing. Because you're cheating yourself of the opportunity to find the truth for yourself and to allow the teaching that's given to help spur you to that. I've given people some teaching that I knew at the time was really asking something of them and really stretching them, and heard later they went right to someone else and got another opinion. And I've seen the effects in people who did that, lived in that way. And it's not good. It's not spiritually helpful. This is these comments I'm making at the present time apply really to anyone who goes to a priest for advice. then you have to be your master. You know, don't waste their time if you're not going to take their advice seriously. But in the master-disciple relationship, then to not commit yourself to that teaching is deadly. It is deadly. What about the risk of this? The risk of it is that you can be misled by your teacher. What if your teacher's got self in it? Let's think of the worst case scenario. What if the teacher's actually manipulating you in some way? My father was a salesman, and he was a very good salesman. A very good salesman, but he was also a very honest salesman. And my dad told me when I was a kid, he said, you can't manipulate someone who's not greedy. And he worked for some companies that sometimes some of the salesmen were manipulative. He knew the manipulative tricks that they pulled. He didn't do it himself. He didn't approve of it. He said, you can't manipulate someone who's not greedy. And that's the same thing as saying you can't manipulate someone who's not afraid. Meditate. Don't worry about the teacher. The teacher makes his or her own karma. Meditate. Find the truth for yourself. But be very careful about drawing the judgment. Especially if you're a disciple, be careful about drawing the judgment that your master is being manipulative or selfish in any other way. Because generally speaking, that's not true. Occasionally it is. And they get the karma of their actions. You get the karma of yours. If you are so anxious to find fault with another that you can't ever take in the teaching, then you only hurt yourself. Moreover, one has to remember that when we are really anxious to find fault with others, it's because we're really habitually finding fault with ourselves and aren't aware of it. We cut others more slack. We give others more faith when we're really trusting ourselves. When we're doubting ourselves, we see reasons to doubt in everything around us. Buddhism is based in personal responsibility. The master is responsible for himself or herself, their own actions. The disciple is responsible for their own actions. If the master makes mistakes, bow to it, learn from them, and go on and don't copy them. And also do not be hasty to judge that it's a mistake. It may look like a mistake and it may not be. Furthermore, it may be a mistake and it may be something that the Eternal is using, putting to very good use. Life is complex. Don't be narrow-minded. In the poem on Trust in the Heart, the very first line by a great master, Kanshi Sosan, the very first line is, the way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Another way it's translated is, the way to the absolute or the way to the ultimate is not hard. Just give up picking and choosing. The commitment within the master-disciple relationship on both sides has to be a full and complete human commitment. And it really helps disciples now and then if, instead of always focusing on themselves, they consider now and then the commitment that the Master is making in taking them on, and the price that the Master pays in teaching and training them and living with them. Her Master would sometimes say, you know, I don't need this. I can live quite well on my own and look after myself. I was doing it, you know, my whole life. No. And it's true. In two or three talks ago, I touched on the kind of situation where a master really, really does seriously crash and burn, so to speak, which is always hard, you know, for them personally and for their disciples and their community members. I also said that it's up to each of us in the end whether it's up to each of us what kind of person we become. We make ourselves into the kind of person we will be through our actions of thought, our actions of word, our actions of body. If we choose to make ourselves as a result of what someone else has done into bitter, vengeful, frightened, untrusting people, there's nothing to stop us. The Eternal's going to stop us, not going to stop us. The universe is not going to stop us. But who do we hurt? We hurt ourselves. There is another path in such situations. And there are always individuals who walk that other path. And it's a path of generosity of spirit and of compassion, of sympathy, and of a trust that transcends right and wrong. A trust that's rooted in a trust in someone's Buddha nature. And a trust that has implicit within it the understanding. It may not, in some cases, be a fully conscious understanding, but eventually it blossoms into a fully conscious understanding that everyone on the path eventually hits patches where they have serious wobbles. This is why, you know, Matthew described the Kechimyaku. It's why there's all these twistings and turnings. It's not just one straight line. It's a line with many, many turns in it. Some of these turns can seem to take one right off the path. And I have learned, both through faith and through personal experience and through observation of the long-term training of others, to be very, very careful about making any judgment that someone has simply walked right off the path. Because I've seen people seem to walk right off the path. And later on, oh, like all of a sudden they disappeared there, right on the path, and a lot further down it than they used to be. A lot further along it than they used to be. What happened there? Well, what happened is between them and the Eternal, not between them and me. Sometimes they give me a little insight into what happened. I always find it really educational and helpful, and it strengthens my faith and my tolerance and my sympathy for others. Rim Master Daizui, God bless his soul, used to say, or as a, since we're Buddhists, God bless his no soul, but God bless him. He used to say, never give up on anyone. And I would really second that. Never give up on anyone. That includes, you know, the master or the abbot who fell right on and did a belly flop in the mud and really made a fool of himself or seemed to do so. That includes them just like everyone else. If you exclude anyone, then at some point you will exclude yourself too. I don't want to be excluded. I don't want to be someone who gives up on me. If I don't want to give up on me, I can't give up on others. And I feel very fortunate that in my almost 40 years now as a monk, I've had the opportunity to see people be someone who did some big belly flops and who, with the help of both the Eternal and other human beings, was able to get back on track. And I've seen other people do it too. I have a lot of faith in the merit, especially the long-term merit of the training we're doing, that it will see us through. I also have a lot of sympathy for people who hit a really hard patch and get really confused and do really perhaps some unwise things. Having been there myself, I don't feel I'm in any position to judge anyone. I also have a lot of sympathy for the people who put so much trust in another person and who, at least for a while, feel very let down, disappointed. And I just say, this is Buddhism, this is not Christianity, this is not psychology. You do not need vengeance for closure. You do not need someone to be punished to have closure, what they call closure. Forget about the damn closure. It doesn't matter. Don't turn yourself into someone you don't want to be. It's not about someone else. It's about me, myself. My discipleship ultimately isn't about my master. It's about me. What kind of disciple I am ultimately is not dependent on my master. It's on me. By the way, it isn't necessarily any easier for disciples to bear the enlightened actions of their master than the unenlightened action. Just look at Lotus Blossom, how many people bailed out at that time. Many of the most senior people, the most respected people in the monastery left at that time. One way or another, everyone's got to cope with the difficulties that are posed them as a disciple. Everyone who's a disciple has to cope one way or another, eventually, with the sheer difficulties of being in that relationship with a master. And if one thing doesn't get you, something else will. And ultimately, it doesn't matter whether it's someone else's enlightened action or unenlightened action. What matters is what one does with it, whether one finds a teaching in it, whether one trains oneself with it. Is what I'm saying making sense? Don't abandon your responsibility for yourself and your own commitment to the precepts because of what anyone does or doesn't do, whether that be enlightened action or unenlightened action. That's their problem. To do Buddhism at the deepest level is very risky. It's very risky and it's very safe at the same time. It's the funniest thing. It boggles the mind. You can't quite comprehend it. It can feel risky and safe at the same time. I remember when I used to encounter this. Not that I don't anymore, but I remember when I was a I've been a monk maybe about 15 years or so. I go through periods where, especially in my relationship with every master, where I would have plowed into a person. I always thought it was like I was hitting my head into a brick wall. There's just something that wouldn't yield there. I'm very glad it didn't. And I'd get upset, and I'd go walk in the woods, up in the north woods of the Abbey. I'd go walk, trudging around, you know, all steamed up and everything. And then I'd notice, part of me's upset, and part of me's not concerned at all about this. It's the most bewildering thing. Part of me's upset, and part of me's actually very peaceful and content, and not at all upset. And it's kind of like I have the choice. Am I going to go with the part of me that's upset, or am I going to go with the part of me that's not upset, and that doesn't care, that's safe and secure? You see? Well, in the long run, I've always gone with the part that was safe and secure. But in the short run, too often, I'm afraid I've made a bit of an ass of myself by going with the part that was upset. And when I've done that, I've regretted it. And when I've gone with the part that was secure, I've always been glad of it. In 1976, Rev. Master wrote the words, "Nothing matters, mindfulness is all." And she used to say, people talk about mindfulness or awareness, but what are we aware of? What is it mindfulness of? It's that part of us that can't be disturbed. It's the iron man within us, that part of us that cannot be upset. I take refuge in the Buddha. The primary meaning of it, I take refuge in the Buddha within. If as a disciple, I always work at taking refuge in the Buddha within, then I'm always secure in my master's, in the master-disciple relationship, whatever is happening within it. Why is that? Because what my discipleship truly is my discipleship to the eternal. The deepest meaning of discipleship is the direct plugged-inness to the eternal. And the eternal uses the human master to lead us to that plugged-inness to itself. And the eternal is not in the least fussy about who the master is and what they're getting up to. This is the part we experience as being so risky. But one has to, in the end, one day one has to deal with that and leap beyond the fear. Leap beyond the fear. And then one finds, as Reverend Master says so magnificently in her article that we've been talking about, the meaning of discipleship, you find that you and the Master are in the same place. You're in the same place. You're one. You're one. I came to Rev. Master in a jodo, where the Master stands before the altar or stands on the altar sometimes, and if you got an altar big enough, it answers questions from the disciples. And in one of these, I came to her and I said, basically, what I'm experiencing is that my section of pipe is now screwed on to your section of pipe, as yours is screwed on to all the Buddhas and ancestors, and there's just this flow through the pipes. I don't even remember what Rev. Master answered, but she basically, the answer was an acknowledgement, yes, this is what happens. This was after I did my big Sangha in 1987. It was maybe a couple years later. Because in that Sangha, the real difficulty where I'd been, the thing that was causing me to keep beating my head against the wall stopped. You know, got help. In that Sangha, it got help. And I stopped the beating my head against the wall. And however, I had been very close to her master, just as one of her disciples, and I'd been very close to her. But that kind of human closeness, the human closeness, is not the same as this knowing with your blood and bones that your section of pipe is now one with your master's section of pipe, which is one with the pipe of the Buddha's ancestors, and there's just this flow through it. And as long as you keep training and keep doing Sangha when you fall down, and you keep your commitment to the path that you're walking, this will be so. And you will know it to be so. When we recite that list of the Buddhas and ancestors, it's not a list of separate names, really. That list of separate names is a way of describing one flow of the transmission that did not originate with man, but that flows through these people. Man did not create the transmission. Man did not create the water of the spirit. We open ourselves to the truth, and the truth flows through us. We can be a vessel of it. None of us owns it. None of us created it, and none of us can destroy it, for that matter. People who are fussy about finding the perfect teacher will never find a teacher. People who are willing to just take the teacher they are given and train wholeheartedly in their discipleship, there's nothing to stop them. Certainly not the teacher. And when great obstacles arise, as long as one keeps up one's training and maintains one's fundamental responsibility for oneself, takes responsibility for oneself, those obstacles will always dissolve. Just as it says in the scripture of great wisdom, they will always dissolve. Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha.